The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, hello there and welcome. You're going to see before you, all right, that's right, I'm a little taller there, two physicists this evening, and I know what you really want to ask is if you've been reading the newspaper or TV. You're starting to laugh already. What you want to know is, do neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light? And is Einstein's theory of relativity wrong? But I've got you as a captive audience, and if I answer that right away, you'll all leave. So it's a tease. But speaking of Einstein's theory of relativity, that magnificent theory, which is probably right, leads me to think about those ideas of in science of beauty, elegance, style, which we might take as a topic even for the evening. I know you're going to say that science and art are very different kinds of things, and they are. There are certain basic differences, but there are also a number of similarities in the sense of both can evoke those feelings of awe of something larger than yourself. And as I say, this is true of both of them. And maybe some of the borders are even getting a little narrower. For instance, I happen to be reading some polls of America's greatest architects, and they were listing the five most impressive constructions of the past 50 years. And several of them listed the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, they listed Bilbao, the Guggenheim, et cetera, and then they list the Hubble Space Telescope. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if Lisa convinces you that the Large Hadron Collider is one of them. There's also other similarities. There are questions of style. Now, you might say, well, science doesn't quite evoke those feelings of passion, of the really that are the essence of human emotions the way art does. But it sometimes can. And there are also similarities in questions, as I said, of style. For instance, if you're a music lover or an art lover, you certainly can distinguish a Schubert quartet from a Beethoven quartet, a Cezanne from a Van Gogh. But if you're a physicist, you can also tell the difference between a paper by Feynman and Schwinger. Or, there's a theory, the Fermi-Dirac theory, which those two gentlemen arrived at independently. But their formulations are totally different. And if you're a physicist, if you ask Lisa or me to say, who did what? We would know the answer right away. Dirac said he was guided by mathematical beauty, and that was the supreme quality for him. Fermi would have never said anything like that. So there are these questions of style as well. These were all rumbling around in my mind as I started my book. And the book is called, I'm looking down at my notes to see what the book is called. No, I'm just kidding. The book is called Ordinary Geniuses, and it's the story of two men born in the first decade of the 20th century. They met when they were in their mid-20s. They met in Copenhagen, which was then the world center of theoretical physics under the benevolent protection of Niels Bohr. The two of them became friends. They worked together for a bit, they laughed together, and that friendship endured as their lives went on. Now, one of those two ordinary geniuses, Georgi Antonovich Gamov. I needn't tell you where he was born, though I can specify the city. It was Odessa. the big melting pot of Russia, the most cosmopolitan city in Russia at the time, and also a city famous for its humor. It is, I think, the only city in the world that I know that has a humor festival still. And if ever there was a citizen of that, of Odessa, it's Gamov. But he was seriously Russian. His grandfather was the metropolitan, the senior figure in the Russian Orthodox Church. And throughout his life, he always loved Russia in some sense, not the Russia of Stalin, but the mother Russia. The second man is named Max Ludwig Henning Delbruck, and he was born in Berlin from a very distinguished Prussian family. His father was a famous professor of history at the university. His childhood friends were elite members of Germany, of Prussia's intellectuals. So they were quite different, but they somehow got along very well. But the real reason I'm writing about them is because they became sort of founding fathers, iconic figures in sort of the two basic questions in science, I think, and namely, how did life begin and how did it organize itself? And how did the universe begin? And how did it evolve? I should add that these are still two extraordinarily exciting questions, and they will be for the next 50, 100, hundreds of years. And they're particularly exciting at this moment because each one has a great unsolved problem. For the universe, the problem is that 95% of this matter out there is something that we don't know anything about. It's called dark matter, dark energy. We give those names, but we don't know what it is. So 95% of the universe is an unknown, and a similar proportion of DNA. We don't quite know what its functions are. It used to be called junk DNA. It's been upgraded to non-coding DNA. But we're going to be exploring that. So I like the idea of going back to these father figures, these iconic figures, these founders of these fields in a way. There's also more personal reasons. They were fun. They were jokers. They performed tricks. They were pranksters. They loved having fun, and people loved being around them. They were also, I should also add, there's one more reason, in that Georgi Antonovich Gamov, who was always known as Joe to his friends, G-E-O, also wrote about 15 books for popular books, for young adults, for everybody. And these were extraordinarily popular in the 40s and 50s. I read several of them at the time. I love them. And I think part of the reason I'm a scientist is for having read them. So just for curiosity, can I see a show of hands? Anybody read a Gamov book when you were younger? Yes. So my favorite is 1, 2, 3, Infinity. He also illustrated the books. He wrote the limericks for them. So 1, 2, 3, Infinity begins with, "There was a young man from Trinity who took the square root of infinity. But when the number of digits gave him the fidgets, he dropped math and switched to divinity." So that's kind of the, you know, the Gamov spirit. They also lived in interesting times. You know, that period there, in the 1930s, Gamov decided he better get out of Russia because he was quite sure that if he stayed, he would have been killed in the Stalinist purges at the end of the 30s. And I do think he would have been executed. Somebody with that kind of sense of humor was doomed. And so he tried to get out. He looked at the border with Finland. He made a trip to the Caucasus. He and his wife even assembled a kayak and tried to row across the Black Sea to Turkey in the kayak. Needless to say, it's about 200 miles they didn't make it. But they finally did get out, and in 1934 they came to the United States. But as I said, there always was this feeling for him of Mother Russia. He would recite Pushkin, which he knew by heart, you know, at the drop of a hat. But he also has fears. He was, later in life, he was paranoid. He was afraid that the Russians would kidnap him and bring him, take him back to Stalin's Russia. This fear increased the closer he got to Russia in his travels around the world. Delbruck came from a staunch anti-Nazi family. His childhood friends, for instance, the Bernhoffers, the two brothers that he used to play with as a child, one of them married Max's sister. They were both executed by Hitler in 1945. He lost a brother. So his family also sort of got wiped out by the Nazis. And yet also for Max, there was this feeling of there is an older, a greater Germany. And he felt a sort of sense of guilt of having survived the war. And he also went back to Germany after the war in the 60s to help start molecular biology. Though he did it in his own way when the chancellor at Göttingen welcomed him to give the inaugural lecture in his ermine robes with the chain. Max came out in a T-shirt and sneakers, you know, to emphasize Germany has to change. So anyway, there are other things about them. They like the pioneering thing. By that was a phrase that Joe used. They like to wander. They did different things in science. In addition, they were what I called ordinary geniuses. Now, why did I call them ordinary geniuses? Well, probably the easiest way to describe that is by telling you about somebody who was not an ordinary genius. And no, I don't mean Einstein. Yes, he wasn't an ordinary genius. But I'll tell you about somebody who was a friend of both of theirs and a mentor to each one of them, particularly to Max. And this is a man named Wolfgang Pauli. So Pauli, at age 20, he wrote a 250-page review of all of the theories of general relativity, all the work that had been done about it. It had 400 references. When Einstein read it, he was stunned that somebody who was 21 years old could read this, could write this. He probably was also stunned that somebody could read it, you know, but certainly that somebody could write it. So Pauli had done Nobel Prize work by the time he was 25, by the time he was 30. He was a distinguished professor in Zurich. He wasn't an ordinary genius. Okay. By contrast, Max wandered a bit. Max's first teaching position was an instructorship at Vanderbilt University, half paid for by the Rockefeller Foundation. He was 35 years old then. Okay. So you see there's a bit of a contrast there. Of course, Max later did very well, but he was an ordinary genius. So what did they do? Okay. Well, let's start with Joe. Joe did some very important work in nuclear physics, but then he liked the pioneering thing. So he started going into stellar structure, into astrophysics, and in the mid-30s began to ask himself, how did the universe begin? How were the elements formed? How was hydrogen, helium, lithium, etc.? How were these elements created? And this is a question that he kept coming back to. And he wrote a very famous paper then about it in 1946, and then an even more famous one in 1948, in which he imagined a universe that explodes from infinitely dense. It explodes. You have essentially what we now call a Big Bang. It's full of radiation, and the elements form in this Big Bang. Now, he didn't coin the term Big Bang. In fact, that was a term coined by a man named Fred Hoyle, also an interesting physicist and a very good speaker, writer, etc. And he had the competing theory in the late 40s and early 50s, which was called the steady state theory, namely that the universe, well, I think steady state gives it away. And to make fun of Gamow, he said, well, I'm talking about the steady state. He talks about the Big Bang. This was supposed to be derogatory, but too bad for Hoyle. The name stuck. It works very well, and in fact, it's even right, whereas the steady state is not. Meanwhile, what was Max doing? Well, Max, who had started in the early 30s, the heyday of quantum mechanics and nuclear physics and so on, was having trouble finding himself. Everybody thought he was both very deep and very smart, but somehow nothing seemed to click quite. So, for instance, his old friend and mentor, Pauli, said to him in 1931, this is in Joe's presence, he said, though he said it in German, I'll say it in English, he said, Max, you're such an interesting man. Why do you write such boring papers? And Max said, And then he decided, okay, I'm going to go write some interesting papers, too. While working sort of as a physicist, he began moonlighting as a biologist, got in touch with some biologists in Berlin, began learning the field, and then in 1935, the three of them wrote a paper, which later became famous, though not at the time. At the time, it was completely ignored. And the last section of it was written by Delbruck, and it said something very simple but quite profound. The question he asked is, what is a gene? Okay. Now, the answer to that in the early 30s, or by the mid-30s, was the gene is the unit of heredity. Stop. And Max said, that's not enough. What is a gene? His answer is, the gene is a big molecule. Like other big molecules. And what is a mutation? A mutation is a rearrangement of the atoms in that molecule. Now, that may not seem like much, but it's an interesting statement. And then in 1937, he had to get out of Germany, and he got a fellowship and went to Caltech, which was then one of the great centers of biology, led by a man named Thomas Hunt Morgan, who had been working on fruit flies for 25 years and knew all there was at that time to know about fruit flies. He got the Nobel Prize, etc. And Max was welcomed at Caltech and said, good, you know, after 25 years of fruit flies, we still have a problem on the, you know, second wing over, you know, in the blue fruit fly. And, you know, maybe in a year you can learn something. And Max said, this is not what I signed up for. I need to find something simple. And he found that something simple. That something simple was a virus that attacks bacteria, called bacteriophage. Now, you can imagine a bacteriophage is sort of like, or a phage is sort of like a pirate ship. They see a nice big cargo ship. The virus goes over. They board it. They take over. Within an hour, the bacterium is dead, and out come lots of bacteria, out come lots of viruses. It's a little monster which takes over the genetic machinery of the bacterium and reorganizes it to make more viruses. And Max said, this is what I've been looking for, a simple system, something that I can do lots of experiments, I can do analyses of it, etc. And he pursued this largely with a young Italian refugee named Salvador Luria, and the two of them became, in a sense, the founding father of the school of bacteriophage, which in a way morphed over into molecular biology. Max also decided in 1945 to start a summer school at Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island, which was an old laboratory, and he said there, we're going to run this every summer, and whoever wants to come, comes for a few weeks, we'll train them how to do experiments in bacteriophage. And they came. The 19-year-old Jim Watson went there, the 52-year-old Leo Szilard went there. And they came out after a few weeks as bacteriophage experts. And Max, with some help from Luria, was kind of the Johnny Appleseed of this movement. Where am I? I think I'm talking about Max. Yes. When this school of bacteriophage research combined with the English School of Crystallography, represented by Jim Watson, Cold Spring Harbor, and Francis Crick, Cambridge Crystallography, with a little help from Maurice Wilkins and Rosalind Franklin, you had DNA, sort of the pivotal moment there. The first letter Watson wrote about their discovery was to Max, his mentor. And he said, Max, look what we found. And Max said, this is going to be something really important. And he wrote his mentor, Niels Bohr, and he said, I think Watson and Crick have found something which is comparable in importance to Rutherford's discovery of the nucleus. And things are going to change. He also said, however, a little later, he was kind of disappointed. Yes, DNA is great, but is that all there is to life? There isn't any deep secret? There isn't anything like quantum mechanics? You mean it's just a big molecule that arranges itself? I'm out of here. So instead of becoming the grand old man of molecular biology, he said, okay, it's time for me to change fields again. And he started studying sensory physiology, and that's what he did for the next 20 years. Meantime, though, Joe comes back into the picture. He was getting a little tired of Big Bang arguments. He read the Watson-Crick paper, and he says, I don't know any biology, but this is a really cool paper. And as you know, DNA has four bases, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, so you can think of it as four different kinds of letters. So Joe said, how many three-letter words can you make with a four-letter alphabet if you say that permutations don't matter? He said, 20. Okay, he says, there are also 20 amino acids, and amino acids make proteins. So I've solved the problem of life. Okay. It's just a three-letter code. And he wrote Watson and Crick a letter. They knew of him as a joker, but they said, you know, for his books and so on, they said, I don't think he's pulling our leg. This is serious. You know, we never even thought there might be a code. Now, of course, it wasn't right. If it was right, Gamow would be one of the most famous biologists of the 20th century, whereas he's not. I think in his words, he said, the solution looks considerably less elegant than the simple construction I suggested, but it has the indisputable advantage of being correct. It is a three-letter code, but there are repetitions. Several of those codons code for the same amino acid. But Gamow, that didn't stop him. He said, this is wonderful. I'm having the time of my life. He started hanging out with Watson and Crick. He formed, as they were studying RNA, because it isn't that simple code. Good. He said, okay, RNA. I'll form a tie club, and we'll have 20 members, and that'll be RNA. And so that's really all I have to say about Max and Joe. I hope I've tried to give you some feeling about who they were. They had crazy ideas and had fun. But above all, I want to leave you to think of the beauty of DNA's double helix and that of the universe's Big Bang. Our distant ancestors already thought about how life in the universe originated, but centuries from now, our era may be remembered as the one when the answers to those mysteries first came to be understood. Thank you. Lisa. And next I have the very great pleasure of introducing Lisa Randall to you.
So I'm shorter. Good evening. So as you might have guessed, since we're both physicists, we don't actually just read from books. That's just not our style. We have more conversation and talking. So I'm actually going to take it a step further and actually give you a little bit of a slideshow. But before I do that, I'm going to mention a couple of things just to tie in with what Gino has just said. First of all, the theme of beauty and art and beauty and how that relates to science is an important one. And actually what I'm trying to do in my book is really illuminate not just how physics work, what the physics that's happening today at, for example, at the Large Hadron Collider, this proton collider that Miriam mentioned, and also about dark matter, which I do talk about, but also sort of how it works in practice. How do we go about making these ideas? In fact, I have a chapter that's entitled Truth and Beauty and Other Scientific Misconceptions to try to say exactly what role beauty plays in deciding what we're doing, and also a chapter on creativity. So these themes are really important. Another theme, though, that's very important is actually the theme of scale. And actually, I don't know if any of you saw it, but I actually had a piece in the Huffington Post that I wrote this weekend to talk about this neutrino faster than the speed of light thing. And part of what I wanted to get across there is kind of why they're doing this measurement and what it means to say Einstein's theory is wrong. Because no matter what they discover, it's hard to imagine that Einstein's theory is just wrong. I mean, you can say Newton's laws are wrong because, after all, quantum mechanics or relativity displaces them, and we see that evidence in certain regimes of parameters. But, you know, it's a really, really good approximation. You can do calculations, you can throw a ball, you can send man to the moon. You don't really need all these other aspects. And so the theory is right. And really, you don't actually have to worry about using that until you have the precision to make a measurement where it would make a difference. So even in the unlikely event, which is unlikely, that this measurement turns out to be right, it isn't going to mean we're going to throw away Einstein's theory. It means probably the most likely interpretation will be that the assumptions on which it's based break down at a very small level in very extreme circumstances. And that's kind of the theme I'm going to explore today. So like I said, in my book I talk about physics and some of the underlying themes that go into how we do science in general, uncertainty and risk, creativity, etc. So I'm just going to try to give you a flavor of it. And I should not use my phone, but I think I'll use the clicker. Okay. Okay, so that's my book cover. Let's just start with a quote from a Suzanne Vega song. And what's so small to you is so large to me. If it's the last thing I do, I'll make you see. This quote sort of indicates an important underlying theme in physics, and also the fact that we really do, in particle physics, study very small structure, and that very small structure has very profound and deep implications for the underlying nature of matter. And so I'll just give you a small flavor of that in my time. But I'm going to start in a very weird way. I'm going to show you a picture, a photograph that someone gave me. So it's a nice photograph. You can probably guess where it's taken. It has all the indications, the Eiffel Tower. It has a nice kiosk with an affiche on it. It has traffic. So you know it's Paris. But what I want you to think about is the fact that when you look at that Eiffel Tower, how you look at it really depends on what your resolution is, what your scale is, what scale you think is appropriate. If you want to imagine the Eiffel Tower, you're not going to zoom in from space because you won't see it. You might see France at some point, but from the sky, but you're not going to see the Eiffel Tower unless you're really close and have the resolution. Similarly, if you had very, very small, very good resolution and looked really close, What you would see is the underlying structure of the iron gridwork. But you're not really going to notice that it's the Eiffel Tower. You'll see this underlying structure. So when you look at the Eiffel Tower, you're not seeing the underlying molecules or atoms. You're seeing the structure that looks like the Eiffel Tower. And it's such an obvious fact, but that's really underlying all we do when we do science, because we have intuition based on what we see, but there can be this underlying structure that we're effectively averaging out because we don't even notice it. And it's the same idea that I talked about a moment ago. But the thing is, what I really wanted you to notice back in this picture was not the Eiffel Tower. I wanted you to notice the kiosk. Because if you zoom in on that, you actually see my name. So what I'll tell you about in the next 15 minutes is how I got to get my name on an affiche in Paris. But let's just start by thinking a little bit about scale. Because it's true, I can go jump right in and tell you, and I'll tell you pretty quickly about some of the particle physics happening today, some of the physics that we do, the physics that I do theory for, that Miriam does theory for, that Gino thinks about as well. But I just want to set it in context, because it's really important to realize that we're not just making this stuff up. There's really a systematic approach to how we got to these scales, and we're really, right now, at the technological limit of distance that we can see. Of course, all of us are used to human scale, the things that we see through visible light with our eyes. Really, kind of this what we see is something ranging from maybe a millimeter to kilometers when we just look. But of course, if you have something smaller than visible light, a few hundred nanometers, you can't see it. It just doesn't have the you just don't have the resolution. I know I think a lot of people would say, well, therefore it doesn't exist. But that just has to do with us and our capacities for seeing. It doesn't have to do with what's actually out there. So part of the challenge of physics over the ages has been to find ways to probe smaller and smaller scales, scales that we don't directly experience in our daily lives, and to find rigorous ways to connect that with what we actually know and believe. So, of course, physics ranges from very large scales, ranging from the size of the known universe, 10 to the 27th meters, down to human scale, which is order of a meter. And there's many objects in between. But one of the striking things about this is that really we're using the same laws of physics over this entire range. We're going to use the laws of gravity. We're going to use basic mechanical laws, electromagnetism. On small scales, and, you know, again, alluded to this, at some point we find that classical laws of physics essentially don't work anymore. They're not describing what happens, and that happens at atomic scales. So if we think about it, we sort of have human scale and sort of sub-microscopic scale, scales that we can see with devices, but then we get down to scales that just our classical laws of physics just don't apply anymore. Now, how do these all connect with each other? Like I said, one is an approximation of the other. So we do know what this means and how to go inside, but we have to be very careful about thinking about the precision with which we're looking. One thing I'd like you to focus on, though, is this Large Hadron Collider. This is shown as a box because what you have is this giant underground ring, 27 kilometers in circumference, and it's underground. There's Geneva or Meran up above. And this is the scale we're probing today, 10 to the minus 19th meters. So it's a lot smaller than the scales that we're familiar with. It's not a scale that we can see in any way. We're seeing it rather indirectly by creating high-energy collisions that allow us to probe short-distance scales. And this is the threshold of where we are in terms of experiment. There's a lot of space in between. I guess space is a bad word, but there's a lot of scales in between. So we can imagine scales all the way down to a scale where we think quantum mechanics and gravity get combined into yet another theory, a quantum gravity theory. But what I'm focused on right now in my research are scales that we can actually hope to observe. And so that's about the scale of, as I said, 10 to the minus 19th meters. And it's pretty exciting right now because those experiments are going on as we speak, as was pointed out. And we can really learn quite a bit more that I'll tell you just a tiny bit about. So let me just remind you, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this, but basically the history of physics has been a history of going in, or at least the recent history, but really the history of science in general is this history of finding tools so that you can probe inside. You can probe smaller and smaller and larger structures. You can probe structures that are distant from what we see in our everyday lives. So if you look at an atom has a tiny nucleus inside. I mean, this podium. And by the way, I forgot to mention, this is probably the most beautiful podium that I've ever had. And it also reminded me that the one honor that I wanted to mention was that I'm also a member of the American Philosophical Society, which is in Philadelphia, meets in Philadelphia, so it gives me an excuse to come here, so it's kind of nice. But this podium is actually made up of atoms. It doesn't look like it. It looks pretty smooth. In fact, it's very smooth. It's been nicely sanded down. But it's made up of these tiny structures called atoms, which we don't see, but which we know are there. And inside that is a tiny nucleus, and that nucleus is not, in turn, not fundamental. It's made up of protons and neutrons, which are themselves made up of more fundamental objects called quarks. So electrons seem to be fundamental, as do these quarks, but we don't know that. In fact, we're trying to find. I mean, they look fundamental at the scales we've seen so far, but we don't know, is there more fundamental structure? Or are there new interactions that are happening at those scales? It's really exciting because we are now at the point where we can start to answer those questions. Right now, actually, it's a shame because usually when I present this talk, I have this great quote from Gamow. Had I been a little more clever, I would have left it in. But I'm going to tell you what it says, more or less. It more or less says that, you know, we've now reached the limit of what matter can probe. And in fact, it was from 1, 2, 3, infinity. And I didn't raise my hand because I didn't read it as a kid. But when I started to write warp passages, it occurred to me that I didn't actually read most of these popular physics books. So maybe I should go glance at some of them. So I looked at this one. I heard it was really good. And indeed, it is really good. But it had this really fantastic quote in it. And it says something like, now we have reached the limit of what's inside matter. Because now we've discovered the proton and the electron. And I think they had one other thing that they discovered. I think the neutrino at that point. But basically, it said, you know, we've now reached the limit. And so it was just an amazing thing to me because the same person who was so excited that they've now discovered this more fundamental structure couldn't imagine that there could be even more structure under that. And again, it's this connection between, you get so bound up in sort of what your technology lets you see that you forget that you really are limited by that technology. And of course, later on, people did discover quarks and gluons that hold them together inside these protons. And what got found also is the neutron. So it's very easy to think this is all magical and mystical and it couldn't possibly be true. But of course, that again, it's always because of what your technology is telling you. And that's why the Large Hadron Collider is so exciting for us, because it really is letting us probe this very, very interesting scale. It's known as the weak energy scale. It's a scale that I'll tell you a little bit more about, but that's what's going on here. We have the Large Hadron Collider. And it's really funny because you can think of it as something as a beautiful thing. And a lot of people have actually gone there and said that. Amusing aside about this is an artist friend of mine pointed out that artists now don't use beauty as their sort of criterion, but scientists do. So, but in a way, it's really impressive when you were to call it beautiful or whatever. This is not impressive because it's just a circle and it's really underground. But the thing itself is rather amazing when you go to visit. So I'll just give you a little bit of a flavor of what happens if this actually works, which it seems to not be working. There's a video. Is that video playing for you? I mean, I know it's not playing here. I can see that. I'm asking a technology person back there. Is there any? Okay, well, what you have to imagine is something really beautiful. So what was there were the protons that were coming down this tunnel, which you can walk through, and I have. And then they meet inside a collision point. So these rings, so there's two beams of protons. They intersect at various collision points. And that's where the exciting stuff happens. When the protons get together, they turn into energy. E equals mc squared, Einstein's formula, so you can make new massive particles with mass m. And that can tell us really interesting things, but you have to know what's there. So they built these enormous detectors around these collision points to record everything they can about these particles, the energy, momentum, their charges, etc. And that's what you can pretend you just saw. Okay. So what are we trying to learn there? Well, we're trying to learn one question, which is how particles acquire their mass. And that might sound like a very strange question. Why shouldn't mass be just some intrinsic property that things have? But the reason is that if you actually just had an intrinsic mass, you would get nonsensical predictions. You would get predictions for probabilities of interactions greater than one. We know that isn't right. And the best answer to what's going on is something called the Higgs mechanism, which I can't explain to you, but I promise you I have a whole chapter explaining it. So the Higgs mechanism, which gives mass to particles, and if that's right, there will be some experimental evidence in the form of particles, maybe a Higgs boson particle, which would be extremely exciting, and that's the search is on, and you periodically hear reports about new bounds on the Higgs boson. Another question is basically the question of the weakness of gravity, which is sort of a question of why masses are what they are. Why is the gravitational force of elementary particles so much weaker than electromagnetism? If I had two elementary particles, it's over 40 orders of magnitude smaller. The only reason gravity seems so strong is because you have the entire Earth acting on you. A magnet can pick up a paperclip. So we know that electromagnetism, a tiny magnet, can compete against the entire Earth. I can jump up and down. That's amazing. The entire Earth is exerting gravity on you. So although gravity seems strong as a fundamental force, it's very weak. And one of the things we hope to learn at the Large Hadron Collider is why that is. And that could have amazing implications, including something about space, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about, because it will tie back into that affiche. So just to put this in the context of what I've been saying, the goals today are to go beyond well-established theories. We have this core of knowledge. We have what's called the standard model of particle physics. It describes matter's most basic elements as we know them and their interactions. It works incredibly well. It's been tested to a high degree of precision. But it leaves open these new questions that can't be explained without some more fundamental framework. As a theorist, we're trying to predict what that could be. We're trying to say, how can the Large Hadron Collider look for that? And then how will it be consistent with what we've seen before? So again, just to emphasize, what the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is doing is going to new energy and distance frontiers. Oh, maybe this one will work. Nope, doesn't work either. This is the end of the collision going through the collider. We discover a particle. You don't get to see it. And that's saying I was there. Okay, so I'm just going to spend a few minutes, and I don't expect you to fully understand everything I'm going to say, but I do want to get back to that opera, which was the thing that's advertised in that affiche. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about stuff that's cut off on the slide, which is, could there be more than three dimensions? See, scale is really important. Why even consider the possibility of extra dimensions? After all, we experience three spatial dimensions, forward, backward, left, right, up, down. And I think most people know that, although I have to say I was recently on Charlie Rose and the intern kept saying, I can't wait till we find out about the third dimension. And the first time I let it go, the second time I was like, you know, should correct that. But we know about three dimensions, but could there be more? And why do we ask that question? Well, first of all, just because we're not going to know the answer unless we ask it. We don't know why there only appear to be three. Einstein's theory of gravity that was mentioned earlier works for any number of dimensions, not just for three. And so we can work out the consequences if there are more. We also know ways they can hide. So we know that there's a possibility there are more. Another is string theory, which I'm not going to talk about too much. But it is a candidate theory of quantum gravity. Again, using the idea we've had about stuff that's hidden, it doesn't really affect things at the scale we can make measurements, but at very distant scales, 16 orders of magnitude, even smaller than the distance that the LHC is exploring, it's possible that a new theory of quantum gravity takes over, and string theory, where things are based on fundamental oscillating strings rather than fundamental particles, could take over. But the best reason, in my opinion, is that we have a possibility of answering questions about our universe. And the only way we're going to know if that's right is by actually just hypothesizing it, is seeing what the experimental consequences are. And I have to admit, when I first started in physics, I probably would have thought this was a crazy idea. But the fact is, people have spent a few decades trying to answer these questions about the weakness of gravity, and we don't have a completely satisfactory answer. So given that this could exist, it seemed worth exploring the possibility. And that's what my collaborator Raman Sundrum and I did. So you need one additional idea here, which is a brain world. It's known as a brain world. And now I know why they have those dotted lines at the top of the slides. It really was on my slide. It was on my slide when I had it on the computer. But basically, There are these objects that can exist if there is a higher dimensional world. They're lower dimensional objects in a higher dimensional world. You can think of it even as a shower curtain in a three-dimensional room. So you might have water droplets stuck on your two-dimensional curtain in a three-dimensional room. And here you might have us, our universe, galaxies, whatever, my cousin, stuck in the three dimensions of our world, even though gravity can go off into the extra dimension. So a brain world is a lower dimensional world in a higher dimensional space. So if you asked, why do we only see three dimensions, the answer could be that light only travels in three dimensions, even if there is another dimension of space that we don't see. We literally don't see. So again, this is rather complicated. I don't expect you to fully understand it, although there will be a quiz. But the idea is that we could have two different brain worlds. And this is something that we worked out. We worked out the consequences of what gravity would look like here. And Raman and I found something rather spectacular, which is that gravity can vary exponentially as you go from one brain to another. So we call it the other brain where gravity is strong, the gravity brain, the brain where gravity is weak, the weak brain, it's the brain we live on. So it could be that gravity is actually comparable in strength as a fundamental force, but we live in a place where gravity is weak. And the really great thing about it, and this is not the really great thing about it, this was just because when I was on the Colbert Report, he asked, so does that mean there's many copies of me in these other universes? This is his picture that I used to have up. And I told him that actually it's not the case, that those other universes are actually quite different, which is something people get confused about when I talk about this. It's not a parallel universe in the sense that we're living on the other universe. We're on our weak brain, but there could be other worlds with completely different laws of physics. Still has gravity, but there could be different forces. But what's really, really exciting about this idea is because it does have something to do with particles physics, it does explain the weakness of gravity, it means that it will have experimental consequences at the Large Hadron Collider if it's right. So when you collide together protons, it can make a particle known as a Kaluza-Klein particle, a particle that travels in extra dimensions that then decays inside the detector so that we can know it was there. So there could be experimental evidence. So it might sound like a kooky idea, but at least we're going to get to test it at the Large Hadron Collider now. And it's actually one of many kooky ideas that are being tested now because we don't know what's there until we actually look. But we know these problems exist and we've found several possible solutions and we're trying to find out which one is right. So these were conceptual ideas in physics that were really important, but I'm just going to close by telling you how these ideas got realized in a couple of art projects. I don't know how much time I have, probably not very much, so I'll probably go through it rather quickly. But I do want to give you a flavor. Oh, I have a few minutes. So I'm just going to give you... So one is a gallery show that I curated. I wanted to do something based on scale. I got my friend Leah Halloran, who's an artist. And we like the idea because a lot of people talk about art science projects. But the question is, how do you do that? I mean, is it just you take a picture of a molecule and you say, that's pretty? Or do you try to do something? So what I thought is, let's take a theme that both artists and scientists can appreciate, namely the idea of scale. And one of the things I really wanted to get across was the way things look different at different scales. So it was wonderful. So we basically curated the exhibit. We had a call for proposals. The artist made pieces for this particular show. It's actually going to move to Harvard in November for those of you who will be there. It'll be at the Carpenter Center. But what they did was really wonderful. So they were all pieces that you actually just stood and stared at for a little while because they really looked different depending on how you looked at them. Right now, it's nowhere. It's going to be at the Carpenter Center at Harvard starting in November. And it originated at the Los Angeles Art Association and was in Gallery A25 in La Cienega. And it's been a couple places now. So it's called Measure for Measure, to play with the idea of scale. And this is a picture. This is actually one of the photographs. It was enormous sequoia that was just to, of course, give you the idea of scale. But what was really fun about the way that Barbara photographed this is that she had many small photographs that she put together to make this big thing. And I think that just illustrates very nicely. I mean, if you look at the photograph on the right, you're seeing very different structure than when you look at the tree on the left. And it's really quite beautiful photography. This one is just fun. What Susan does is she takes old books, and she took books related to the theme of scale in this case, Alice in Wonderland and Gulliver's Travels, and she basically carved them out so that instead of having the individual pictures, when you put them together, you get a whole different structure in itself. And there's several more, but I'm just going to show you one more, which is Katrina McElroy, which actually, I lost a picture there. And so on the left, you can see that it's sort of a pop art kind of thing. But on the right, when you zoom in, you see that what you have is actually pictures of people's faces. So again, when you look at small scale, you see something very different than when you look on large scale. And I'm just going to close by giving a flavor of the opera, which indeed premiered at the Pompidou Center. It's been a few places since, and they started to play it too soon. Basically, we want to explore both the theme of physics. Hector Power is a composer. He invited me to do something. Can you lower that a little bit so I can talk? Can you lower it? So he invited me to work with him. He wanted to do something related to physics. And so we wanted to explore the theme of discovery and creativity. So there were two characters. One was trying to compose music and trying to understand the universe, decide that what they see is not all there is. And one thought that their three-dimensional universe is all there is. So we use the extra dimension as sort of a metaphor for discovery. So I'll just flip through those a little bit now so we can start playing that. You can start playing now, just to give an idea. And so there's two. One is living in a different world and is allowed to live. So they start off together, but then she's allowed to explore. And so I should say Matthew Ritchie did the sets, and this is his iconic bridge thing, but the idea is that there's a lot less color in one world. I mean, one of the challenges was trying to see how to actually represent a higher dimensional versus a lower dimensional world. And we also had another challenge, which is the Pompidou Center doesn't have an orchestra pit, so we actually had screens that were sort of translucent sometimes where you could see the orchestra behind. It's kind of fun. Figuring out how to do the geometry. And so you can see she's exploring this new world that he can't. And one of the other things that themes was sort of, what does it mean to do an experiment? I mean, she's directly exploring this new world, but of course, people who live in the three-dimensional world, you have to somehow convey that information back. And he really wanted physics, so he insisted on having an equation. And this is just going through. So I'll just conclude. I'll let the music play out. But I think I've conveyed somewhat is that there's probably more in the universe than we see. And this picture I saw happened to see at the Tate. It's called After Lunch by Patrick Caulfield. And it sort of conveyed the idea that there can be this richer universe that lies beyond. And what I didn't know when I actually chose this picture is that there was actually the Chateau de Sion, which is actually very close to CERN, where the Large Hadron Collider is located. So it probably means something. So I think there's just a lot out to explore, and I hope I've given you a sense of just how we go and proceed beyond where we are. I mean, you heard a little bit about how new fields are created, but I think this is a different way in which we sort of systematically build on what came before. And sometimes we'll find something that radically changes ideas, but even when it does so, there'll still be this core of knowledge that remains. I think biology is in a very different state, and I talk about that a little bit, in the sense that we haven't gotten to that point where things are that systematic. You don't have that kind of thing yet. But in physics, we really have a systematic building on that scale. So I will say thank you, and thank you for introducing me.
Right. Okay.
So thank you for bearing with us through all the various technical difficulties. We've got about 15 minutes for questions, so raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. Sound should come out of it. Please wait for the mic. The lady in the red in the fifth row.
You showed the gravity brain and the other brain. If they're governed by different physical laws, how do they interact with each other? Because the laws will be different.
Right. So basically, all we know is that they interact through gravity. It could be that there are other forces through which they interact, but it could be that something like electromagnetism. So a particle has a charge. And so that charge can be stuck on a brain. And if that's true, you would only experience that force on that brain. Gravity, of course, has to go throughout the whole of space because gravity interacts with energy, and energy can be anywhere. So we know that gravity spreads throughout, but the other forces might not. So it could be that there are particles of one type of charge, like electric charge on our brain. They could be a completely different kind of charge that would go right through us that lives on the other brain.
Another question?
I should say brain is a word that comes from membrane, in case people were wondering. It's B-R-A-N-E.
Gentleman in the blue in the same room.
What do you think about the notion that there are four infinite dimensions of space and the Big Bang is just one of an infinite number of randomly sized and randomly distributed quantum fluctuations in that infinite four-dimensional space, and the direction of futurity is simply the local entropy gradient at any point in that four-dimensional space?
Well, I'll say something first. I mean, I think that this is just a period of great flux in cosmology, and great flux is exciting, and there are, you know, a lot of theories out there. Is the universe a hologram? Are there many universes? Are there essentially an infinite number of universes disconnected from us that we will never know anything about? Different universes in which the laws of physics or laws of science are completely different. You know, in some ways, we're beginning to depart from what we conventionally think of as science, namely things that can be tested and proven either right or wrong. So it's exciting, but it's also a little worrisome at times.
Okay, but we're saying we here, but I would say that we try not to depart from that any more than we have to.
Yeah.
So, yes, people do speculate about these things, and certainly it's theoretically possible. I mean, I wouldn't say that it replaces the Big Bang. I would say, and I wouldn't even say that necessarily put it in your dimensional terms. But it could be that there are multiple universes out there. And there's so far, I mean, after all, we know this universe has existed for a finite amount of time, about 13.7 billion years. That means that, because the speed of light is finite, at least so we think, that means that we can only see so far out, which would tell us that if something is more than that, more distant than that, it's essentially inaccessible to us. Even though we all interact gravitationally, we still wouldn't have time to get to see that other universe. So this other universe can exist, and in fact, it's possible, and people have speculated it to try to explain certain properties like dark energy, for example, why we have this particular value, which is a really weird value of dark energy. But it's not necessarily replacing the Big Bang either. It's something that would be superimposed on top of it. The Big Bang has been tested extremely well. We've seen the expansion of the universe. We've seen the microwave background. We've seen the Hubble expansion. We've seen even nucleosynthesis predictions work. So we're not throwing away the Big Bang theory all that fast, but we might find, again, some fundamental underlying theory. In this case, it is theory, and it's hard to even imagine an experiment to tell you about it. So it's a very different sort of endeavor.
I'd also like to add that this is something that one should approach with a fair amount of humility. You know, humans evolved a couple of million years ago from the savanna. We've been, you know, civilization as we know it has existed for a few thousand years. And isn't it really amazing that we can think of what the universe was like, you know, 10 after 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the beginning? So let's also reflect for a second of how amazing it is.
This civilization, I mean, I'd like to think what we were like 10
right?
years ago.
A few more questions. Gentleman about seven rows back on the aisle.
Hi, we have been trying to find Higgs boson and trying to figure out why matter has mass. But to my understanding, mass is nothing but just a, I mean, gravity is nothing but an interaction between maybe particles or whatever. It's a kind of an energy field. But here on Earth, we consider mass as a very important thing, because if something has mass, it is something, and if it doesn't have mass, it is like it isn't there. Like we talk about space, like space is like nothing, but in fact there are a lot of energies flowing through the space.
That's not true, because like something like a photon, which mediates light, is massless. It has zero mass. So what mass tells you is, for any given particle, what the relation between its energy and its momentum is. So mass means something very specific. It has to do with, in some sense, how it interacts with gravity. But gravity interacts with both. I mean, this is the dirty secret that you usually don't hear, because you usually hear equals mc squared. But really, it involves, there's a more deep formula that involves momentum as well. So gravity interacts with both energy and momentum. And mass is sort of telling you that relationship. So I should say also, I mean, and this is another thing that you'll know that a lot of your friends won't, that particles have mass. I mean, sort of stuff has mass even without the Higgs mechanism, because there is a different kind of mass that comes about because of the strong force. So protons and neutrons have mass through equals mc squared. There's energy holding them together, and that gives them mass. When we talk about the Higgs mechanism, we're talking about the masses for fundamental elementary particles. Those also have to have mass, because otherwise that structure would never have formed. Everything would have been moving at the speed of light. So it would never collapse, so that it can form structure. So the Higgs mechanism is doing something very specific in terms of giving elementary particles their mass.
Yeah.
Gentleman in the second row here.
Thank you. My English is not very good, but I want to ask two questions.
Sir, please hold it to one question, because we have many people in the audience.
Okay.
Pick the best one.
If I send a stream of the water in one direction, all that water that cross a transaction area is the same. It's in one dimension. But if it's in three dimensions,
the volume?
One moment. There is an argument against a space of more than three dimensions. It is the accuracy of the number two in the law of Coulomb's law. The number two is very accuracy. That is a very strong argument for me that the space for electrical interaction is three dimensions.
Okay, so I think I know what question you're asking. So I'm going to try to ask it and tell me if I'm right. So basically, if you look at the, so probably some of you have heard about the 1/r² force law of gravity, the inverse square law, Newton's inverse square law, which means that if you take two masses and you take them further away, the force between them decreases like 1/(distance)². Now, that's not hard to understand. It was just pointed out. Because we live in three dimensions of space. So suppose you imagine an object with mass and it emits force lines around it. So those force lines are going to get surrounded by a sphere, because the gravitational force is the same in every direction of space. And as you go further away, that sphere grows. The area of that sphere grows like r², the distance squared. And so the force, the number of force lines intersecting you, is going down like 1/r². So how can you possibly have extra dimensions of space and consistently with this force law? And the answer, I talk about this a lot more in war passages. I talk about this, but it has to do, there's two reasons, essentially. One is that those extra dimensions can be really tiny. So you just don't have the chance to go that far. So once you get beyond the size of the extra dimension, you no longer notice it. And again, it's consistent with this idea of scale. Until you get to the distance that you can see that extra dimension, you just don't see it. It doesn't have an effect. The other way, which is more subtle and has to do with the kind of geometry I presented, has to do with the warped geometry. The idea that you can have gravity so that it's not spreading out equally in all the dimensions, and that's what's going on in that case, so that gravity actually gets confined in some sense, not strictly speaking confined, but concentrates near one of the brains so it doesn't really spread out as much in the other direction. And that's why that in that case it would be consistent. So actually, Raman and I, in addition to explaining this weakness of gravity, we found a new way of hiding a dimension that people hadn't thought of since Einstein's theory by accident.
Okay. Gentleman in the four rows back on your left, Marzu.
Thank you very much. I apologize if you already covered this. I did have to step out for a second. My question is about tachyons. did I miss something?
Yeah.
I remember, now I'm a music major,
and
I've been out of college for 10 years, so forgive me if I'm a little off here. But I remember seeing something or reading something somewhere about tachyons having been observed seemingly instantly moving from one place to another place when it was actually just they were moving too fast to be observed in the process of the motion or something like that. In relation to that and Einsteinian relativity, I mean, I get really confused when you're talking about time things. It seems to me almost like they're arriving at a destination before they've departed from the origin. And my question is, like, considering these extra dimensions, is that even possible?
So
you want to?
I'll just take that. I can take that part, which is that actually, I mean, this is one of the things I actually mentioned. I actually have an article about faster than light. And so the craziest interpretation would be that time travel is possible, in the sense that no one knows how to make sense of that. It is actually conceivable, and it's not necessarily true, but if you have extra dimensions, you can have a small violation. In fact, you don't even need extra dimensions necessarily for that, but one scenario has been developed after Raman and IGF theory, where the symmetries on which Einstein's theory are based are violated a little bit. Those symmetries are such that they tell you that there's this fixed speed of light. So if they are violated a little bit, you could conceivably have different speeds, even for massless objects. So not everything travels at the speed of light. So it's conceivable that you could have fast and light travel without this weird paradoxes of time travel. But you were absolutely right that the reason time travel is always confusing in movies, haven't you noticed that when you see these movies, you're like, why did they just worry about that
fun.
Little effect?
What? Time travel is fun in movies.
It's fun, but it never makes sense. I'm like, why did they just get rid of the bad guy in the first place so that he wasn't born? You know, they always do this really funny. And it's just because, you know, it doesn't make sense. And so basically it's up to them when they want to stop playing the game and start making sense again. So you're right.
The thing with the time travel movies is always how they control the spatial coordinates with the time. Because it's like, if you're traveling from here to 30 years ago, how are you going to be in the same spot on the Earth?
Woo.
Hey, these are movies, you know.
Yeah, but they still have to have some internal logic.
So we've got time for one more question. There was a lady with her hand up on our left again.
I'm not even sure I can phrase this question, but Dr. E. Randall, you said something about the Big Bang took place X years ago, 13 billion or... You can put a time on that, and if you can put a time on that,
what happened before then?
Well, that's, but how is that different from saying that God spoke 5,000 years ago, or...
How about a place? Can you give us a place where it took place, how far from the Earth it is currently?
No.
No, you can't. Because space itself didn't exist then.
It took place everywhere, just space gets bigger.
Space didn't exist?
Let me say one thing, which is that the one thing we really don't know about the Big Bang is what banged and what happened then. I mean, and this is, again, the systematic thing that we keep expanding our knowledge. So we can look back further and further in time. We can look at smaller and smaller distances, hotter temperatures, in some sense, higher energies. We don't know what happened in the beginning. So people always talk about origins, but that's the one thing we really don't know. We don't know that for evolution. We don't know that for space. I mean, we can keep trying to get closer, but we don't have it. But having said that, what we know about our universe is that if you extrapolate it back, you can extrapolate it back based on the Big Bang theory, which definitely works in our recent history. You can extrapolate it back this amount of time. What was happening then, we don't know, but we do. But if you were to, but we do know that in some sense the visible universe was smaller then, because the universe had existed for a much shorter amount of time, and light travels at a finite speed. So if you, let's not just go back to the very beginning, because that's really confusing, but if you go back, you know, when the universe is, say, 10 to minus 15 seconds old, well, the only distance is that the size of the visible universe would be 10 to minus 15 seconds times the speed of light. And as you go further and further, as the universe is older and older, it becomes a bigger universe. So basically, we can look at the universe today, extrapolate back. But to ask the question of where we are doesn't make sense, because space, it's, because two things are changing in some sense. There's distance in terms of the size of objects, but there's also distance in terms of the overall scale, which is changing as the universe expands.
Yeah, there's also, I might add, there are a lot of theories of what happened before the Big Bang. Was there a bounce, you know, for instance, was there a bouncing universe or something like that? But I'll just recommend, there's one book written by one of the finest physicists in the world, a man named Steve Weinberg, and it's called The First 3 Minutes. And it, what discusses is, the topic is, what happened in the universe's first 3 minutes? And it takes it sort of second by second, minute by minute, and it goes back now to Gamow. And the question is, when did hydrogen form, when did helium, when did nuclei form, and then eventually when did atoms form? So this is the true archaeology, or it's one form of archaeology of the past, of studying not ancient civilization, but the ancient history of the universe. And it really is remarkable that one can say when
but
helium
again,
nuclei form.
I just want to emphasize, and I do really like that book, but I want to emphasize, we talk about the first 3 minutes, but we don't know what was happening in that very beginning. There's no theory adequate to describe it.
But we have a pretty good idea what happened after the, you know, a fraction of a second, right?
Well, we still are a bit uncertain. We think inflation happened. We don't know what caused it.
I said only a fraction of a second. I didn't say a teeny fraction of a second.
Yeah, and that's an important difference. And so
yes.
That's
back to the question of scale, right?
Exactly.
Well, when did it scale?
So large to me.
Thank you to Lisa Randall, Gino Segre, and give us a few minutes and we'll meet you upstairs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.